Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I am joined by Christina Congleton, and we're going to be talking about some of the big ideas in her book, Getting Over Ourselves, Moving Beyond a Culture of Burnout, Loneliness, and Narcissism. And in a sense, we're going to be making sense together of the journey we've both been on over these last years. We'll talk about the meta crisis. We'll talk about how we've made sense of modernity, neoliberalism, some of the economic theories that are influencing the crises that we face in our times. And we'll talk about what that means for the work we do in coaching and the role of developmental psychology, indigenous wisdom, and other ideas that help us move through these times. Christina is a professional coach. She coaches through her practice, Axon Leadership, working with managers and C-suite executives. She holds an EDM in human development and psychology from Harvard University and a BA in biopsychology and creative writing from Oberlin College. Let's dive in. This is the podcast with Christina Congleton. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Christina, yeah, it's our little preamble, our little check-in had me really excited to record this conversation with you. So could you, well, first of all, how are you?
I'm all the things, you know. You mentioned as we were coming in, you know, just like we were talking about the state of the world, right? So I'm really good. Personally, I'm very grateful for my life and my work and all these things. And then I'm troubled, I'm challenged, I'm in the unknown in so many ways. And that's an okay place to be. And actually, I want to be with more people in that space. But I'm really good. And it's early in the morning for me. So I'm starting my day this way, and I'm glad to see you.
Yeah, so much in what you just share there that resonates with me. Could you say to people listening just a little, just in a couple of sentences or a few more, like who, what are you up to? Like, who are you?
So I have found myself in this life to be a leadership coach, and that is what I do day in and day out. And I'm often coming in with bigger organizations or consultancies to offer coaching to leaders. I work a lot in businesses, and I've done work in government and nonprofit and all of that. My days are a lot of one-on-one meetings, sometimes working with groups, sometimes doing a little teaching or facilitation. And I'm a wife and a mother, so that's actually the bedrock of my life, as many people will probably relate to. And I got the opportunity to write this book, and I guess to say something. The book we'll talk about a bit today called Getting Over Ourselves, which we'll unpack what that means. Because it doesn't mean get over yourself, get over it. That's not what the intention there. It's a little more playful, actually, how I think of it. But my background, I studied biopsychology in college. I grew up in Maine and then went to Oberlin College, and I studied biopsychology and creative writing, which was a cool combination. And I worked in brain imaging labs early in my career. So I actually got to like scan people's brains. I was doing that in part because I've always really been interested in human development, human potential, which I hope we're actually going to get to unpack in this conversation, because I think of it differently now than I did in my early 20s. And I studied adult development in graduate school at Harvard, and moved more fully into leadership coaching. But actually trained as a coach in my mid-20s when I was in the field of brain imaging research. So I was kind of developing those capacities as a practitioner while still in science. So getting to write a book was really exciting, to kind of bring together everything I knew and was seeing and kind of go to the edge for me, which is what the offering of the book is.
Something you said there, I want to actually pick up on, and I know we'll probably talk about w how you see human potential unfolding, and we'll get into that in more detail maybe later in the conversation, because I want to kind of set more context for that. But you just said, like, I see human potential as something different than I used to. How do you see it differently these days?
Well, I would there bring in something from developmental psychology. Is that I don't want to
Yeah,
jump the gun there,
just
but
give us a kind of sense of how's your view changed on what human potential is these days.
So something I've become aware of. There are different ways. So when we're talking about this, adult developmental psychology, just to be specific, it's there are models that I've explored in my life and in graduate school and with Coaches Rising, because you all have done beautiful courses on developmental coaching, right? So this is the work that came out of Lovinger and Suzanne Cook Reuter, and Robert Keegan, of course, and Jennifer Garvey Berger, the beautiful Jennifer Garvey Berger, who I know you interviewed recently. And something that, well, one thing. So in writing the book, I wanted to include those models and that knowledge of what I would say specifically here is Western developmental psychology. It's particularly applicable to kind of, people use this term weird, right? I think the weird world needs to get weirder, but we, white, educated, industrial, and I forget the rest, but a lot of people probably who are listening to this conversation, that that model is really valuable, I think, to the Western trajectory of development and can help us with our Western modern minds. And there are different ways that those models are depicted. They can be depicted like a ladder, right? There's the probably well known to many spiral, upward spiral of development that I think is interesting in that it combines like cycles with linearity, right? If you think of like a spiral, it's like a cycle that's going somewhere. So it kind of brings to maybe more ancient senses of time as a cycle. It brings in that like linearity that really came in strongly with the Enlightenment in the 16 and 1700s. But then the model and metaphor, right? Because these models, these ways of depicting are teachings in a sense. The one that has really captivated me is the arc, which really is attributed to Suzanne Cookreuter, and is coming out in different ways. But when I started to look at that arc, if we think of the vertical axis in that as individualism, right? Kind of like when we think of Western development, it's like we appreciate, we start as this dependent being and we gain our independence, and our social structures and systems really encourage that. And it's actually gotten a little out of hand, which we'll talk about in the last 40 odd years. You know, there's this encouragement toward independence. And at the height of that arc, we're kind of at the height of individuality, in a sense of, and that's a certain expression of being a human being. But as that arc continues, we slide back down the other side. You know, I say in my book, there's a way that the invitation is to begin sliding, however awkwardly, down the other side of that arc into our interdependence, our entanglement, the limits of our self-authority and self-authorship, and to really come back down to earth. And that, I think, is a huge part of the invitation of our times, especially for those of us who are really steeped in this Western modern, at this point, hyper individualized culture. Yeah,
beautiful. Another word that comes to mind is like deconstructing the sense of self that we've constructed on the way up of that arc. And you said these times are an invitation into that move, and you know our kind of hyper individualized societies in the West has been a topic of our podcast quite a bit recently. And what does that mean for our work as coaches in our field? And could you say more about, I'm sure we're going to go into this territory of developmental psychology and this arc more, but why do you think these times are an invitation into that, you know, sliding down that arc?
Like, why is it happening, or why do I think that?
Yeah, in a sense, like, because you said these times feel like they're an invitation to move down that arc, if I heard you right, but maybe I heard it wrong, but that somehow resonates with me. And but I wonder what you feel these times are an invitation.
So one thing I was thinking about this, Joel, one thing I want to say is that, and it actually brings up emotion for me, that it's an invitation, it is an invitation and can be felt as such. And that's quite inviting for some of us. And then for others, it is a situation of survival, right? Like, and what I'm naming here is I'm naming privilege in a sense. Like, I think it's good actually to contextualize ourselves, right? And acknowledge that, and I don't, you know, we get to sit here and talk about this, and I'm not trying to shame us, right? Like, I think this is an important, beautiful conversation, but I want to say, for some people, it's not an invitation. It is, their worlds are already on fire. The seas are already rising. And I think to actually feel that and acknowledge that is important, because we're kind of still in this place, as far as I can see, in the industrialized West, where we're kind of it's kind of a choice at this time. It's a choice whether or not we feel the ground under our feet. We're kind of I have a sense it's like we find ourselves kind of suspended in the air in a way. And there are these really interesting things happening where now some people are like, hey, let's merge with AI and just like totally dissociate into technology and not have to be here. And like, maybe we'll just go into the matrix or whatever, you know, I mean, that's kind of like, it's kind of a funny way to say it, but, and there may be choices, you know, that are made. I think what I feel called into and what moves my heart and has actually brought about so much expansion and more relaxation for me is to really start to get the lack of separation of me from the earth, right? Really, and really that's it. To really start to recognize like it's all one, a very diverse one thing. It's not like we're all just one thing, but like, we're not separate. We're part of the ecosystem, you know, and I think this concept will be familiar to a lot of people listening, but to really start to recognize that in a deeper felt, more lived way. And I'm not saying I have that all figured out. Like, I'm not living some pristine, perfectly eco-aligned life. Like, I actually really want to be clear about that. I'm in the tension of it, but to really start to feel that belonging actually that comes with responsibility and care for for our home, for each other, for the animals and the rocks, and not responsibility like put the weight on our shoulders, but actually the love and reverence and what we want to give when we recognize that. Yeah. And I think there's an invitation there that's very beautiful for humanity, especially those of us that are kind of find ourselves quite far from the ground in some ways.
And I'm kind of sort of tuning into the collective and the individual in the sense of, you know, in one sense, we're talking about each of our own individual journeys through our lives as we, you know, as we become independent and then potentially become very interdependent, we open into that. But also there's this collective sense right now, you know, there's very common phrases of time between worlds, liminal times. I mean, I think it's, you know, we first spoke a year ago, and I think it's even more palpable now that we're in a, you know, it's just very accepted and common, maybe not in mainstream media yet, but that we're in a period of like tremendous transformation, change. It's very destabilizing.
Yes.
And, you know, confronting and challenging.
Yes.
But also remarkable. I think it's important not to only put kind of negative labels on it, but that there's a collective element to this, you know, which I think is
Absolutely.
Pointing to what you're saying, that actually we're intimately woven together, and that there's a cultural worldview that's being rocked with institutions inside of that are being rocked. And that's confronting. But also, as in our own individual lives, when something happens and it's very challenging, but opens up a potential for us to mature, is the same possibility here for us on a collective level. And so that's what I'm tuning into. And as I hear you speak, like it reminds me of this. Yeah, I don't know if you want the I questions bubble up, but I don't know if there's anything you want to share on what I just said.
Yeah, I think I'd just add that while the conversation we have here might be different in many ways from what we see in the mainstream, in a sense, people know this. People feel like, you go to the grocery, look around, and yeah, we're all like going through our lives, but I think it's quite common that people feel some sense of destabilization. Like we see symptoms of this, right? To name two things, when the general population is polled, I think this is probably kind of US-centric, this data, but trust in institutions has just gone down decade after decade. There's and this is, we're seeing this, right? We're seeing this really I don't know. I mean, it's strange in some ways. Like the political scene, I think everyone's kind of like, what's going on? I mean, we can also get into certainties about it, right? But I think a lot of people are like, what? In the US, who are the Republicans? Who are the Democrats? Like, which side am I on? What's going on? Right. Like, I think that's actually felt widely. And that's why these conversations, I think, are even more valuable. And like another data point, actually, a lot of the things I talk about in my book, we're now talking about, pandemics or, crises of loneliness, of stress in the general population. So we're feeling it, but people are feeling it. And I, what actually excites me is to like interrogate it and be like, what's true? What's really going on here? And that's another part of the invitation, I think, to, and I think it's exciting. It's not like as coaches, we're necessarily gonna, well, actually, I'd say I wouldn't recommend sitting down with your client being like, this is what's happening. And did you see this thing about the system? Like, that's not really what we do as coaches. But I think if we're more informed, if we're more aware, discerning, it's gonna affect our own development and way of being and the way we can see and be with our clients.
Exactly. I mean, so this is, I think this is a big theme in our field right now in terms of what's our role as a coach, and do we coach within a particular worldview which may be, collapsing, coming, breaking down in ways, or do we have one foot in what's emerging and one foot in what's declining?
Yes.
And
Yes.
I
Yeah.
think there's there, so I'm seeing a big theme now around agency. So, and I think it's connected to what we're talking about in that coaching has tended to, well, perhaps coaching in some ways has been part of this hyper individualistic worldview. So it's really about coaching the individual. You're there separate from me. We atomize leadership as if it's somehow separate from the system or the team, and it's three in one person. So you can see how some of these beliefs are encoded within the way we coach and what we see human potential is. And so you see now ways of coaching which are, I think, addressing that, like people like Peter Hawkins talking about coaching relationships, the relationships between things, not the things themselves, or what does the world want us to talk about in our coaching session today? And I think that this theme of agency is a part of this. So I'm seeing like people like Benita Roy talking about post-formal actors, or Peter Limburger, who's talked about agentic sages. So the marrying, which is not never was separate, but bringing the inner and outer together, you know, so the inner work and, you know, learning how to design new worlds, ontological design. So I kind of forgot why I started going off on that one, but I think it's, I guess it's speaking to, you know, our industry itself, connecting what we've been talking about to our industry and how things are going to change and the role of a coach, you know? So maybe, and I've talked a lot here, so I'll stop, but maybe whilst we're not here to impose our agenda on our clients, maybe we have a certain role to at least be able to situate our coaching conversation within this wider world. And our clients are bringing it in anyway, you know?
Yes.
They're bringing it in anyway. So,
Yeah. So one thing I'd say, and I think it's actually quite simple to just name that that has become so important to me, is that to really try to understand our client and also their context. And because a lot can happen in coaching, like someone, I was reading the analogy the other day of like, if, you know, if we're coaching a fish, you know, this common analogy, like the fish in water, if we're coaching the fish and the fish has to go back into water, that, for example, there could be a situation where a fish has to go back into very toxic water, right? Organizations have their beauty and their difficulties, right? So it's not like every organization is toxic, but I do think the seeing is important, that, you know, if we've had amazing openings, the person is feeling themselves more, they're feeling the world more, which I actually think is really important. And I think is one of the very important keys to our times. And then they're going in and they're feeling the difficulty of the system. They're more aware of things that are hurting them. And that's also part of the dynamic, right? So I think the systemic lens and like really trying to also understand what's going on in the world. Like, what are the underlying assumptions of the economy, for example? And how does that come through and shape us as in our individual lives and compel us in certain ways? What are the limitations there? And, you know, I do think, like I was this UN environment program report just came out, and it's interesting, you know, like a lot, like a 287, I'm actually looking at something on my screen, 287 multidisciplinary scientists from 82 countries came together and they're talking about like things have to change. It's 1200 pages. I haven't read the whole thing, but we know that things are going to need to change. Probably some of it's going to be easy and some of it's going to be really hard. But to really try to see our client, try to see our client's entanglement, right? And further our entanglement with all of that, and try to understand that. I think without moving quickly to strong positions, I mean, discernment and like moral clarity is really important. Like I'm not saying don't discern what's right or wrong, but to really try to see like what's the bigger picture here, and to see ourselves in context is just a really simple, powerful, simple / complicated move as a coach.
What are some of the entanglements or the contexts that we're sat within that you think are important for us to begin to recognize, in a sense, like the water that as fish we're swimming in? I'm thinking, you know, perpetual growth, you know, as a common kind of deep belief that's not often questioned, particularly in the mainstream. But what do you think? I mean, we've mentioned like neoliberalism Maybe that the notion of what the self is, what it means to. Could you say what do you think are some of the important entanglements that we should name?
Well, you've just named some huge things right there. And the two that are popping out are perpetual growth and what the individual is. So maybe we can move this into neoliberalism. I think first I want to say that actually, I think there are really important, beautiful conversations opening up about capitalism, for example. And even when I say that, like this past summer, I had the chance to be at this small conference and someone had presented and who was an economist. And I was really curious. And I was like, I just lobbed a big question. And I was like, do you think that there's anything better than capitalism? And the person immediately started talking about communism and why that wasn't a good system. And I was like, oh, I'm not talking about communism, you know? So I do think first it's good just to see our knee-jerk reactions and our reactivity that can come up and just talking about, hey, let's just talk about the system that's going on now. Let's just get clear about what it is and how it works. And I'm not an economist, so I can't go like deep into all the economics, but we are in a system that requires growth quarter after quarter, right? That it requires more extraction and more consumption. And we won't get into like the monetary system. I mean, you can go deep on this and really try to understand it just to get clear, right? Like, how does this work? And what I can say from the things I've listened to and learned is that there are assumptions about what a person is in our economic system. And one is that, I guess there are different ways to say this, a couple understandings I can say is that one, we're self-interested, we're out for ourselves. So there's a way that is an assumption and therefore our economic system asks us to be out for ourselves. And that resources are scarce, that there's scarcity and that we need to compete. So these are named in economic classes, like at universities. So it's not a secret. So can we recognize the assumptions and work with those? And this is a big topic, but I do think that, like for me in my interrogation in the book, what I was really looking at is what's my conditioning, not just from my family system, right? But these broader waters in which we swim, the assumptions of the economy that I'm living in, the government, where I live, what's the bigger global context, and how does that shape me? So I'll stop there and see. I've said some things. There's so much more to it, but let's see where we want to go.
But you can see how those, I mean, first of all, I can feel the viscerality of those ideas and how they show up in my life and how there's actually a tension in my own life between, competing for resources, like having enough money and living in a system that almost like, that requires a lot of money to live in it.
Yes.
And then, the desire to kind of break free from that, even though I don't know what it would break free into. And it's very easy to get very utopian and kind of critical of something like capitalism when you can see that it's, a kind of crony capitalism right now. But at the same time, I don't know what alternatives there are. Although I'm now, this is interesting as a theme, which is unsurprising. This theme of alternatives to capitalism is starting to come up a lot. And I've had guests on the podcast recently who said, "Oh, you know, there are very credible alternatives out there that are well researched, you know, and are being explored." And so I didn't know that, you know. So it's good to know that it sounds like there's a movement growing. But I guess my point is, you know, in a sense, where you're highlighting the way our system's designed and what it's like to live inside of it. And so this is, I think, again, sort of why I think these conversations are important for us as coaches, is that we're not coaching in the world of like 15 years ago. I think if we talked about this 15 years ago, first of all, no one would really have cared, and probably it wouldn't really have mattered that much, or maybe 20 years ago. But but now it's like the you can feel it. So, I think this is kind of coming to me around why I think agency and ontological design is and you know, post-formal actors, Benita Roy, so people who can actually start to. You know, we talked about developmental psychology. What are the deep beliefs and structures of the way we govern and relate that we're subject to, that are being shaken, that we're starting to see as an object, which, you know, gives us more possibility to design new worlds, you know, and actually that the leaders and executives that we work with, that I think is going to become an important capacity in our times, you know, that we're because of the uncertainty and rapid pace of change, we're going to have to become a lot more adaptable, and that requires a certain spaciousness and maturity, a capacity to feel maybe new ca capacities that we have moved away from in modernity, when we only use our rational minds to, but also, yeah, kind of real world tools to be able to design new, you know, and navigate in complex terrain. So
Well, I want to name a couple things. I know at least a little bit about some of the thinkers you've named, and they're awesome. And then, like, I think it's important to keep rounding out kind of the voices. I think I recommend people read. I'm reading right now, Vanessa Andreotti, or Vanessa Machado de Oliveira's Hospicing Modernity, and now she has Outgrowing Modernity. I think she brings such a powerful view as someone who is at a university in Canada and works deeply with Indigenous people in the Amazon, I believe. So these, and then I have studied a lot in the last couple of years, especially since I finished my book with Bioa Kamilafe, who I know you've talked to, Joel, right? And he part of what I'm seeing here is that I'm a little. I think design and like seeing solutions and alternatives is really good and exciting. It's great. I think we also, at the same time, there's an important role of like being a little suspicious of ourselves. And I kind of say that playfully too, right? Like our modern minds will go for clarity, we'll go for the next answer, right? We'll go for a bright, shiny alternative that we get excited about. And it's not like saying we can't do that or that's wrong. But I think there's a lot of, we need to be very suspicious of ourselves. And that's like, I called the book Getting Over Ourselves, not to, and it's really getting over like a much smaller sense of self. It's actually getting over like, this separate, increasingly perfect kind of sense of self. That's what I want to interrogate, not who we really are. Like, that's something I want to say. There's actually this much, actually a much bigger potential for us when that falls apart. And when we're, when we know deep relationality, when we know humility, which is, and I describe this in my book, humility, if you look at the meaning of humility, it's not like, oh, I'm humble. I'm not a big deal. Humility comes from the root word for earth. It means to be of the earth. It goes back to what I said earlier, is actually recognizing ourselves as part of, and human means earthling. And so to slide down that developmental arc, get our feet back down on the ground, and like really listen to each other, see the part, the reactive parts of ourself that might be going for solution. Because the people I trust the most these days are the people who stand up and say, I don't know. I don't know. And I'm willing to not know with you so that we can fumble around a bit, you know? Because the kind of heroic, exciting but also limited drive to, you know, have the next solution. And I'm not, again, like, I'm, you know, I think there's a lot of great stuff. There's regenerative economics, right? There's lots of beautiful stuff, and we should be paying attention. And yes, I say yes. And yet there's something about the not knowing, the fumbling and the stumbling, the willing to be, bio says this, the willingness to be not put together. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is, I think, another one of the, I can't remember what the word you used, but this is another, I think, one of these ideas we've inherited, you know, about being clear, even keeled, not knowing. And so I love you bring this in, you know, and I can feel, I can feel the, what is it? It's like tempers some of the kind of zeal around, oh, designing new worlds, you know, because that could all be co-opted by, you know, a kind of the same, all the beautiful ideas that emerge that are in response to the current worldview we have can be then consumed and co-opted by the current worldview. So
right,
I
there,
mean, that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I love people like Bio, because he's just such a, you know, I don't even know what the word is, but he speaks so beautifully. He pulls the rug from under the feet of these attempts to do so. And and he hasn't been co-opted into the tent, you know, so you should check out his writing and his speaking. But that was humbling for me this year to be on retreat and have the teacher I was with point directly to my tendency to want to be even keeled and put together, and how that's baked into the field of coaching too. You know, I think a lot of coaches, you know, certainly when you're like selling your coaching, you know, it's like, I'm helping you to, maximize your potential or get what you want, to get clear, to gain a sense of direction. You know, and those, again, it's like you say, they're not bad. You know, it's not like we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but it's to see how to be suspicious and to recognize. Let me say that to sit in not being put together on that retreat was just very, very challenging, and yet, wow, you know, to feel the the sense of light that it gets paradoxical because it's like, it wasn't like suddenly, oh, then I allowed myself not to be put together and then I felt suddenly better, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is that there was a kind of beauty to it.
Yes.
There was a poetry and a beauty and a love to it that was inherently fulfilling without, you know, trying to be put back together. So I think this is really important what you bring.
Yeah. And that's, thank you for speaking to that. And as well, all of it, and the part where it's like, oh, I'll fall apart and then I'll be perfect, right? It's really fascinating how like the logics have momentum, right? And they neoliberalism, and we can unpack that for people because it's probably helpful, but neoliberalism is a fascinating beast. I mean, the way it lures us back into its promises of perfect freedom and autonomy and certainty and a kind of perfection, a kind of idealism, the way it like what you named just there, it's like our and we can see our mind do that, and that's probably part of why you were able to actually be in the realness of it, right, Joel? I don't want to speak for you, but it's like to see like, oh, now my mind is like, okay, now we're going to fall apart, and now we'll have all the answers and I'll be so bright and shiny. But what's interesting is my experience, maybe I can, because this is more like the spiritual lens. Reality is incredibly beautiful, right? It's like, and to go to something you said, as coaches, we're like, yeah, I'm going to help you get what you want. And that's where a good inquiry for a coach, I think we need to respect whatever the client puts on the table, by the way. Like, there's really this humility and like, let's be with that and let's look at that and not make assumptions about them. But at the same time, to be in the question of what does the person really want? What do people really want? What's deeper in our hearts and souls, right? Because I don't think anybody wants to trash this place, the earth. I don't think we want to be doing what we're doing right now. So why are we doing it? I think to feel into those deeper questions are compelling and beautiful and need to be very humbling to us as coaches. I think that's a beautiful trajectory as a coach. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much a both and I think another just another thing that's coming to me here is how even are our stories of collapse actually co-opted into our own kind of Western view of the world. So, a mentor of mine who lives in the East, who's very well, just a brilliant person and very profound thinker and well connected, was, you know, I was talking about collapse, and he said, "Well, that's a very like mo that's a very monolithic view of collapse, and it's very typical of like the Western people I talk to who." Because I li he lives in the East, and he's like, it's not, it's that we don't have the same atmosphere over here that you have in Europe, and if you look in this part of the world, there's a different atmosphere there, and so he was pointing towards how there's, you know, there are areas around the world that are, I don't want to use the word rising and falling, but it's like it's much more nuanced, and yes, of course, we're all globally connected in a way that we've never been before in history, and that's, you know, when it comes to the meta crisis, a really, you know, global warming is not going to spare it doesn't think in terms of global regions, and even though it is regionalized. So I think that helped me loosen a little bit too. And maybe this segues us back to developmental psychology, and how you see it being a supportive kind of idea, that points to our experience. So it's a map, but it points to a territory. Because even developmental psychology, we could kind of say, hey, and we've talked about this, haven't we? That this has arisen inside of a kind of Western mindset of what it means to be a successful human. There are many other views on what it means to be human around the world, which actually maybe are, actually have people live in a deeper harmony with the planet. And there have been many challenges to the way we hold developmental psychology of how it views what a human is. But so I'm layering in a lot to this question of like how let's talk about developmental psychology and why it's an important view, an idea. I think you already talked about it really, and that there's this arc, and so we've set that part up. Maybe we could nuance that a little bit more.
I mean, I guess what's good to name here, and you did some podcasts on this. I don't think you've talked to Nora Bateson, but I just want to give credit where credit's due. I don't know Nora Bateson personally. I listen to her a lot. She wrote, I think it was just this one line Facebook post that was developmental models are colonial, period.
And eugenics, even connected to eugenics, We
And
tried to get her on the podcast. She was up for it, but then it just didn't happen. So we can try again. Yeah, I'd
Oh, that
love to
would be
talk to
so
her.
great. Yeah, I
Yeah.
would definitely tune in and I would encourage others. I appreciate Nora Bateson. And actually, anyway, she's doing all the warm data stuff. And I think actually that's I haven't done it, but it sounds so relevant to coaching, develop this kind of coaching that you and I are interested in. So I think, that all that, I'm so grateful for all that because it rocked my world. And I'll just name, I was at a place in where I came back and, I've studied developmental psychology, but I did, it's called the Art of Developmental Coaching that you all do at Coaches Rising. I did it again and you had Tyson Yunkaporta on, who I love, Tyson Yunkaporta. That's another amazing thinker that I would invite people to tune into. And he didn't, I think I'd like to hear him say more about developmental models now. He said some things, but I don't totally get his thinking. He's very critical, but our idealized things, they need to be smashed, right? They need to be challenged. We need to interrogate them. And I think I was someone who was really into all that stuff, and I had kind of idealizations of further development and all this stuff, right? Which I've kind of come to see as part of that achiever center of gravity that is very strong in the world right now. So, just to name it again, I do think Cookreuter's arc, and Beena Sharma uses this, Beena Sharma, who, am I getting her name right? She comes on here a lot. She's done a lot of work with you guys. I think she's a phenomenal practitioner. She uses the arc, and for me to, so the colonial move is to kind of try to have the single story and impose it everywhere, right? Which is kind of analogous to a lot of what's come out of Western modern culture of everybody should do it this way. This is the way. And I'm not even saying that's all bad, but I do think we're at a time of reckoning with colonialism, right? With which you and I have gotten into, recognizing our extractive practices, our kind of extractive, competitive, you know, he who has the most toys when he dies wins kind of grab. And I think that developmental psychology, it's both and, right? It tells a beautiful story of forms of liberation of mind, because, you know, if we look at self-authorship, we could probably, some things probably go back even further. In my book, I say we definitely at least want to go back to the Enlightenment, because if you read like What is Enlightenment by Kant, you know, he was basically saying, hey, everybody's just like getting a doctor to answer these questions, and, you know, having clergy answer these questions, and, you know, just saying this book has all the answers. Like, think for yourself. It's like, have the courage to use your own reasoning, basically, was the message of the Enlightenment. And when I read about it, it feels like a super exciting time. It was like I read about it a little in my book, you know, people were like discovering coffee in these cafes in France. And can you imagine like discovering coffee, right? The Encyclopedia was this incredibly subversive book that was like smuggled in places. I mean, if we can kind of feel what that must have been like when people were like throwing off convention, right? And saying, wait a minute, I want to find out for myself. And this led to, you know, these scientific discoveries and different ways of organizing the economy and all of it, right? There's something beautiful about it, but then it also like, it was in some ways a trajectory of further retreating into rationality and separation and the separate self. And we've kind of like, I think neoliberal ideology, this hyper individualism of today, is like this crescendo of separation and individualism that we really want to see clearly and feel into what we really want and what's really true. And the developmental model, I think, in seeing like, how do we move into that more, you know, we talk about like, I don't know if pre-conventional is really fair, but like there's like a conventional mind, right? That is just very prevalent in terms of the Western mind. And there's like something beyond that and what's calling to us.
Do you think, because this is, there's a both and here. So on the one hand, I think the way that these models have been challenged is that in some sense they've been encapsulated in that kind of mind, which says there's, or that maybe the originators of the models didn't hold it like this, but the way they're interpreted is that there's this like linear gradual trajectory to our development, and that we can, you know, through our work, manage that in a very step-by-step kind of way.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, it ignores the kind of non-linear, messy, unbidden nature of how we grow. You know, you said before, like actually periods of not being put together are part of that. So I guess, because I got caught early on in my life immediately, which I think is probably true of most people. It's like, oh, I want to develop to the end faster. You know, how can
oh,
I get
yeah,
to
like,
the, how can I win
yeah,
this, get
we,
to the end
we,
faster?
We're in a club together, Joel, like, you know, I'm a card carrying member. I guess like I'm right there with you is all I want to say. Yeah. I was like, I see that in myself. Yeah.
And I think the more I matured, the more I felt like I regressed down the model. It's like I remember like a dear friend of mine saying, like, because Ken Wilber has this like second tier notion, and he was like, we're second tier. And I remember saying like, I don't know about that. I realized, like, I don't know. It's quite a cool thing to say because, you can get carried away with it. But I feel like as I've gotten older, it's almost like I've gone the opposite that like down further.
But
I'm
down
saying
further
all
in
this
what
is
way?
like,
What do you mean by that? Down.
well, I think it's what's true is I've become, in a way, I was defended against my immaturity, and I had an inflated sense of my maturity. And as I've actually
Got it.
matured, it's been a process of meeting my shadow, meeting all the parts of me that I wasn't, that I didn't value. There was a bypassing taking place. So it's not actually a regression, but it's a allowing in all the parts of me that weren't allowed to be here, that I felt ashamed about or didn't like. So I think this is like a long way around to, and let me just say what the, because the question is almost like, yeah, maybe this is it. I remember someone saying to me, and I think this gets to something important in what we're saying. It's like we can get caught in this idea that like I can grow myself, Like, oh, I'm gonna, okay, so now I know about developmental psychology and I'm a coach, I'm gonna grow myself. But actually, like life is growing us, So it's like the inversion almost. It's like life is growing us all the time. How could you separate yourself out from life to kind of grow yourself? It's like a kind of misnomer. And I think it accentuates that kind of like there's a separate me from the world, and I can grow that separate me, somehow disconnected from the world. But actually, we're intimately interwoven with our context and our lineage and our ancestors and our worldview and our families, and that we are co-created, co-arising, and growing all the time. So when I heard Dave Snowden, who also has been critical of developmental models, but talked about Keegan's stages as modulators of experience, which I just didn't understand what he was talking about. That's partly because he tends to use quite obtuse language, I think, sometimes on purpose, maybe so that you can't just kind of grab it and appropriate it. But I think what I started to see was like, if I'm arising in relationship to the world rather than the world is created in relationship to me, then there are moments when experience modulates a kind of self-transforming Joel or a self-authored Joel. And there are moments when a socialized Joel arises. So
Sure. Yeah, I've got experience too. Yeah.
I guess this is like a long way around to saying like what is the use, what is the impact of these developmental models, and how can we hold them in a way that's useful yet not kind of where that we overreach with them or fall into some of the traps, what do you think is the invitation with them?
I mean, big question, right? And I and yeah, a beautiful question. Yeah, I'm just like, at first I'm just like struck by the question, and I'm in the question. I mean, what, like, two things that are prompted by what you just said. Like, I just want to say, I think, like, at this point in my life, I think the ultimate developmental move is to like kneel and kiss the ground and let life have its way with us, right? With our hearts, with our minds, with our hands, like to really let, to let what we love and what we want to know and what we care about, like actually move us. Like, I think that's kind of like, and you know, I'm being absolute here when I'm saying it's the ultimate developmental move. There are so many, right? But I think that's a good message for us to hold. Like, I mean, try like just laying on the ground. There's something about that right now. It might sound kind of stupid, but it's really like, there is this way we need to humble ourselves. And I think one way I find the developmental models really useful at this point for me is to actually, it helps me see what keeps catching me. I'm thinking about, you know, Snowden's frame of like the modulators or the kind of, I don't actually know what I'm saying when I say modulator, but I'm thinking of it as like a pull, right? I mean, Wilbur used the term center of gravity. There's like a pull to these logics. And, you know, and here's where I can, you said something important before about the time between worlds. My podcast that I've started that I'll invite people to is called Friends Between Worlds. It kind of draws off of Zach Stein's, what he said about the time between worlds. So first, I think that land of challenge, of play, of helping each other through this kind of strange postmodern, whatever postmodern is going to be, landscape is so important. But I think the model can also just help me see, you named it earlier, it's like that achiever mindset, that's what, you know, self-authored or achiever. First of all, it has its beauty to it, and it has its greedy kind of pull on the human psyche as well. And it promises growth and, you know, being better than you are today. And some kind of, attainment, right? And being put together in a better, prettier, smarter, more coherent, you know, more powerful way where you're gonna be something, right? And to let ourselves slide and kind of slosh around in interdependence is not that. And so when we catch that, I'm going to develop, like, you know, one thing I say about it, it's like, we're trying to like get the, we're trying to step on the next rung, and we just keep, there's nothing there. And we have to learn how to fall a bit. So there, you know, development can be very scary, like rending some of these veils of self-image and idealization and, what we take ourselves to be that, that is separated from, you know, the glowing beauty of reality, the glowing beauty, mess, all of it, challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. Tom Murray's written really well on the premature deconstruction of our self, you know, that occurs in development, because you know, if we've not done certain, if we've not kind of integrated certain, it can kick up a lot, basically, you know, if we, because there's, and this is again, like a really interesting question, and we probably would benefit from having someone like Suzanne Cook-Reuter with us to, because I know she loves these kinds of conversations. On the one hand, there's, this sense of interdependency you're talking about, and so there's something very wholesome about recognizing a move back into intimacy, like intimate flow with experience, with nature, with the world, with others. You know, one of the you know, I've heard Jennifer Garvey Berger talk about one of the, I don't know if Clinton, downsides of the self-authored self, but it can be, you know, you've constructed your own castle of who you are and what the world is, in some sense. And so I can feel with my wife where if I'm ensconced within myself, forth itself, like, well, this is my thing, here, and you're in your thing over there. There's a certain relationality that's missing, and it's vulnerable to open into that relationality and be transformed together. But it's also when I do that, it's like incredibly, it feels much better. It feels a lot better than being in my castle. So there's a beauty to the interdependence, but there's, if you think about construct aware, like there can be, it can be destabilizing, huh? Like really, like, well, these recognizing the way I want to construct what my world is and who I am in relationship to the world, and that actually many of those constructs, I guess in a way this is kind of partly what we're talking about, isn't it? They might not be, they're constructs, they're actually constructs, and there are other constructs, and there's an experience beyond constructs. Anyway, I guess I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, but
You
it
know,
feels,
can I say something in response to that? Maybe a critical question of our time is like what castles are really worth building? What, 'cause not all cultures on this earth built castles, right? They might have had, I think one thing I think about our Western way of knowing, I guess I'm in the question of like, is self-authorship a gift or an aberration, like a mistake? I mean, I think both of those are probably too strong, but some cultures kind of teach about belonging and being part of things and reciprocity from the beginning of life. And it's not to idealize any one culture or like set some people, like there's this weird thing we can do where we like idealize, indigenous culture or people, right? And we kind of dehumanize them in that. Like these are other human beings. But I think there's a reason why those worldviews are, they're in that UN environmental program report. Like there's all these nods to like we need to listen to indigenous communities, we need to pay attention locally. And there's something too happening in this moment with humanity where people are being kind of pointed back to their place on the earth. So I'm just kind of tying that in because like self-authorship's not a given necessarily. And I don't think it's bad. I talked about the Enlightenment a bit. Like it was this exciting thing that happened, but then like I think we also can interrogate that a bit. Does that
I'm
make
thinking of
sense?
the work of Jean Gebser and Jeremy Johnson's book, Seeing Through the World. I found that really
I haven't
powerful.
read that, yeah.
It's actually really recommend it because Gebser had like a really beautiful view of development. I don't know if if he called it that, but he talked about these mutations of consciousness. So it breaks out of the linear when you start to see them as mutations, that you break out of a linear trajectory with them. And he really honors the gifts of each mutation, mythic, magic, modern, and integral. And his notion of integral is much more, I find, much more ecological and post rational than I've seen in some of the other developmental models. And I think in a way it's like a kind of certain sensibility or a it's very kind of holographic and visceral and ecological, present, filled with presence. And I would recommend people listening to check out Jeremy Johnson's work, because I think he's someone whose work is like bridging some of the gap, the bridging some of the bridges between the different perspectives that we're talking about
Yeah.
alongside people like Bio and Nora Bates. And these are all really, really beautiful people to check out. As we move to the end of our conversation, I wonder if there's anything you want to add or anything we haven't named that's important.
Well, I guess just I do feel moved to say this because it's part of my own learning that I really do. How do I want to say this? I really think I recommend that those of us who recognize our modern minds not try to cram other cultures into the developmental models, right? That's just something I feel moved to say. Like, I don't know the work that you're referring to, but I'm really like I feel the tragedy that has happened of Western thinkers, like, you know, kind of trying to fold and cram other cultures into the models. So I just wanted to say that as like a caution. And you know, I think it's good for us to like learn. And I took a class, I'll just recommend a class. I took a class with Dr. Lila June Johnston this year through Gaia Education, called, what was it? It was about Indigenous worldviews anyway. And I recommend Lila June's, TED Talk. And, you know, there's like a posture of humility and learning that I just want to encourage in myself. And I want to offer to other people because that's one thing I'm really clear with the developmental models is I'm not going to try to cram other people's cosmologies in. I think it's, I kind of like take responsibility and guidance from it as a Westernized person, right? Who's kind of struggling with my modern mind and seeing its limits in the context of what's going on the earth ecologically and socially and all of these things. So I just wanted to put those two cents in there that's a form of humility that I think is really beautiful to play with at this time and I think promising. I wanted to say that. And I know we're coming to the end of our time. What else would we like to do here, Joel?
Well, maybe I love that you share that. That's I think a really, really potent invitation.
Yeah.
Maybe just to say, like, where, you know, can you tell us the title of the book again and where can we find out more about your work?
Yeah. So the book is called Getting Over Ourselves, Moving Beyond a Culture of Burnout, Loneliness, and Narcissism. And I look a lot at kind of neoliberal ideology in that book and kind of lean into developmental models to try to unpack that and understand that and not offer solutions, but maybe like reorientations or different beacons, maybe of lightness and darkness that might call us forward. Because we tend to want to go towards the light, and even that needs to be interrogated, right? So that's the book, and I'd love for people to read it. I really want to be in conversation about it. You know, you can buy it, but you can also, I'm inspired by someone I had on my podcast who said, ask your library to get it. You know, like just if you're in a place in the world where there are public libraries, like ask your library too, because then it's there for the community. And I think that's a beautiful way too. So that's the book. I really want to let people know about my podcast that's just starting. As I mentioned earlier, it's called Friends Between Worlds. And in the podcast, I'm interviewing people I quote in the book. So the book is, it's kind of a synthesis. It's like I was seeing all these things and all these inputs were coming into my brain and I was seeing all these connections and it was my effort to kind of organize it and say, whoa, I'm seeing all this and offer it. And so I'm interviewing people I've quoted and I've only one of them's up, but probably another one will be up by the time this comes out. I've interviewed LAU Saraswati. She's a professor of women's studies and she talks about social media and neoliberalism and some other things. Dr. Olivia Sagan is a psychologist, and she talks about loneliness. She's really studied loneliness. And I've just talked to Janine Canty too, who wrote a book called Returning the Self to Nature. So some really interesting people that you may not have heard of, you know? So I really want to invite people to listen to that. It'll be on, you know, all the places that you can find podcasts. And my website is axonleadership.com. And I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm going to try to engage more in conversation. So certainly people are welcome to connect. I'll also say that with a podcast, you know, that's like an offering. At some point, I want to hold some spaces, some like live spaces adjacent to that for people to come together. I'm doing some training that will help me hold those spaces. So that's not live yet, but I really, you know, even as I say this, I feel like connection, conversation, deep listening, knowing what we care about and speaking from a place of heart. These are all really important things in the challenging slash brimming with potential slash brimming with difficulty, you know, context we find ourselves in. And I think, you know, genuine connection is, it's always going to be needed. It's really important. So I want to invite people into that.
Thanks, Christina. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And yeah, I'm sure people will be inspired to check those things out. So
yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it, Joel. And I appreciate, you know, what you do with Coaches Rising and your curiosity and leaning in. And it was really fun just to like lean in together and kind of play with some of the ideas. So I really thank you, Joel. Yeah, I'm a fan. And that's one of my superpowers is fangirl. So.
All right. Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper, we've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.